Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today is the first part in a two-part series on Greatest Britain, Sir Francis Drake. And I will be joined today, as always, by Max Musson from Western Spring.
Well, shall we move into our Greatest Britons for this week then, Max?
Yes, that'd be good.
We have a new Greatest Briton. We have picked Sir Francis Drake for this week. It'll probably be two or three episodes where we take a look at this great man, this great Briton. Sir Francis Drake was an English explorer, a sea captain, a privateer, a slave trader, and we'll get more into that, just whether he was a slave trader or not, a naval officer and a politician. And we're probably well aware of what each of those are, apart from possibly privateer. And a privateer is a private person or ship that engages in maritime warfare under a commission of war. Since robbery under arms was a common aspect of seaborne trade until the early 19th century, all merchant ships carried arms. A sovereign or delegated authority issued commissions, also referred to as a letter of marque, during wartime. The commission empowered the holder to carry on all forms of hostility permissible at sea by the usages of war. This included attacking foreign vessels and taking them as prizes and taking prize crews as prisoners for exchange. Captured ships were subject to condemnation and sale under prize law, with the proceeds divided by percentage between the privateer's sponsors, ship owners, captains and crew, and a percentage share usually went to the issuer of the commission, i.e. the sovereign. So basically they were legalised pirates. If a country was at war with another country, or a country was getting on the verge of declaring war, they, before they would actually declare war, they might do this, they might issue letters of marque to the ships and the vessels that wanted them, and if they saw a vessel that was at sea by the enemy power, then they could take that vessel and they would be entitled to half of everything that they could get from selling that vessel. And they also didn't mistreat the people that were on these vessels, as we'll see as we get further on, because Sir Francis Drake was looked at as if he was a pirate by the Spanish, but he was looked at as a great hero by the British because he was this this privateer. And we're going to get into that before we get into his circumnavigation as well. Max, have you got anything you'd like to say on privateers or anything about Sir Francis Drake?
Well, only that Sir Francis Drake was, when I was a schoolboy, was lionized as one of the greatest Britons, a great sailor, and it's a great shame that the pursuit of glory, I suppose, is now sort of regarded as being such an awful thing, because Sir Francis Drake was the sort of person who could see that the world was opening up to people who were exploring, and that there were possibilities created. If you explored enough of the world, you would find situations where it was possible for you to make lots of money and to become a very wealthy person. It was a way in which lots of people of fairly humble origins made fortunes for themselves. And it wasn't just us that did it. It was other countries that were doing it as well. And so there was a period of kind of free for all. And Francis Drake was just regarded as one of the people who firstly became very wealthy from doing that kind of thing, but also was very famous for defeating the Spanish Armada and saving Britain from invasion by the Spanish.
He did all sorts of fantastic things. The 16th century, the world was just starting to open up. You could have lots of adventures if you were a young man in the 16th century. And he didn't start off from the aristocracy either. Well, Drake is best known for his circumnavigation of the world in a single expedition from 1577 to 1580. And this included his incursion into the Pacific Ocean, which was until then an area of exclusive Spanish interest. And his claim to New Albion for England, an area in what is now the US state of California. His expedition inaugurated an era of conflict with the Spanish on the western coast of the Americas, an area that had previously been largely unexplored by Western shipping. Elizabeth I awarded Drake a knighthood in 1581, which he received on the Golden Hind in Deptford. In the same year, he was appointed the Mayor of Plymouth. As a Vice Admiral, he was second in command of the English fleet in the victorious battle against the Spanish Armada in 1588. After unsuccessfully attacking San Juan, Puerto Rico, he died of dysentery in January 1596. Drake's exploits made him a hero to the English, but his privateering led the Spanish to brand him a pirate, known to them as El Drac. King Philip II of Spain allegedly offered a reward of 20,000 ducats for his capture or death, which is equivalent to around £6 million in 2015. So he was very important to Spain. Spain was a huge country at this time, and England was fairly small. This was before the British Empire. We were talking about Elizabeth I in our last episode of Greatest Britons, and Sir Francis Drake formed a part of that, and we learned there a little bit about the problems that we had with Spain. But Spain had a huge empire, and really it spread itself too thin. All the brightest and the best of the Spaniards went off empire building, and they really didn't leave that many left at home. The same happened to Portugal. Portugal had a huge great empire at one time in the past as well. And now if you look at Spain and Portugal, they're really not that important in the scheme of things. And a lot of it was that their best DNA, their best genes, actually left the country. But I guess it's all ups and downs. We had our British Empire for a couple of hundred years, and now we're back to being just a little island again. Got any comments on this, Max, at all?
One of the things that I believe affected Spain, and it may be that it affected Portugal in the same way, was that as part of their conquest of Central America, they the conquistadors were in battle with, I think it was the Incas or whatever, but I'm not quite sure which country it is in today, but in part of South America around Peru, there is the largest gold mine that there has ever been. Was it a gold mine or a silver mine? I'm sort of recounting this from memory, but so it may have been silver actually. But there was the largest mine of its sort of precious metal in the world, and the Spanish just kept sending their galleons over there, and they were then just loading them up with coins that they were minting with this precious metal that they were mining there, and sailing it back to Europe. And then of course they then had massive spending power and were able to buy weaponry, were able to buy machinery, and so the Spanish Empire thrived because it had this constant supply of almost unlimited supply of gold, literally a license to mint money, and that appears to have only been a temporary advantage for them.
Yeah, well, it would appear that that's really when they fell out with Britain, that was their weak spot, was that they were carrying all this bullion over from South America in their ships. And obviously, we're pretty good at sea, being the British. We've had our navy since Alfred the Great. We're known for our sea power, basically. And Sir Francis Drake was taking a portion of that, the gold and the silver as it was coming back, because we were almost at war with them before we actually entered into the hot war. This is what we were doing. It actually sort of reminds me a bit of what's been going on between America and Russia. You know, we're not actually at war with them, but we're funding the Ukraine. We've been doing all we can to poke the Russian bear for the last few years. And this was a similar thing back then. Instead of actually declaring open war, you would start paying these privateers and they would start helping themselves to whatever was on your ships as they were coming back from the New World. So that plays into this, Max, I think, because there were quite a few, as we'll hear, quite a few instances where he took gold bullion, gold coins and silver coins. And he's actually at the source of lots of legends of buried treasure. But to take a look at his early life, he was the eldest of the 12 sons of Edmund Drake, who was a Protestant farmer. So he didn't come from the aristocracy. He came from a hard-working family. He wasn't born into wealth or anything like that. He was born to a Protestant farmer. Because of religious persecution during the Prayer Book Rebellion in 1549, the Drake family fled from Devon to Kent, and that was a localized rebellion in Cornwall and Devon. Once he was there, Drake's father obtained an appointment to minister to the men in the King's Navy. He was ordained deacon and was made the vicar of Upnor Church on the Medway. Drake's father apprenticed him to his neighbour, the master of a bark used for coastal trade, transporting merchandise to France. And the ship's master was so satisfied with the young Drake's conduct that, being unmarried and childless at his death, he bequeathed the bark to Drake. So at a very young age, he's been given a ship because the ship's master was so impressed with him. Anecdotal evidence indicates that Francis next served in a fairly humble capacity as a seaman on a series of voyages on the ships of John Hawkins between 1560 and 1568. As just a humble sailor, Drake is seldom mentioned by name in any of the records. They carried mainly cloth and manufactured goods, often contraband, but piracy was also a lure. On a trip to Guinea, John Hawkins brought home to England valuable cargoes of gold, ivory, pepper, and an idea. The West African slave trade was officially a Portuguese monopoly, but John Hawkins devised a plan to break into that trade, and in 1562 enlisted the aid of friends and family to finance his venture, and it was a success. Hawkins returned in 1563 a rich man. Hawkins immediately began planning his next trip, gaining both Queen Elizabeth's support in the form of a ship, the Jesus de Lubeck, and the rest of his needed venture capital from a consortium of investors. Drake was 20 years old at the time, and not a member of that consortium when he sailed on Hawkins' second voyage, but the crew would have received a share in the profits. Therefore, scholars such as Chris Lane list Drake with Hawkins as one of the first English slave traders. I'll just stop there because he wasn't involved in this. He got a share of the profits, but he wasn't actually involved in taking the slaves. And later on, we'll hear that he freed slaves. He had a slave on his vessel, a freed slave that turned out to be a close friend of his throughout his life. And yet now we're being told he was one of the first English slave traders. And it's not like they were going on to Africa and kidnapping these Africans. What they would have been doing was undercutting the Portuguese. They would have found some way of doing this. Portugal was obviously in alliance with Spain, and this was part of the undermining of the economy of the Spanish and the Portuguese. And he wasn't involved in planning this at all. You could say that the slaves themselves were benefiting from this because they were fed and they were clothed and they were looked after by the English slave traders. It's a scandal, really, that they attack him for this, especially in view of what happened later on. But they claim here that he was one of the first English slave traders, and I don't think you would have read that in information on Sir Francis Drake 5 years ago. I don't think they would have mentioned anything about it. Well, that second run was also a success. However, the Spanish and the Portuguese had become aware of what the English were doing. So they sent their London ambassadors to lodge complaints with Queen Elizabeth. Spain and Portugal were the major seafaring powers of the 16th century, holding established trade monopolies, including the West African slave trade. England was small, relatively poor, and struggling from civil and religious division. And Elizabeth was not yet willing to risk war with Spain. So the Queen instructed Hawkins not to undertake a third trip that year. Hawkins agreed and then covertly furnished John Lovell with a fleet to do it for him. Drake's presence on earlier voyages has been mostly assumed, but there is firm testimony that Drake was on board one of Lovell's ships for this voyage. In 1566 to 67, sailing under Captain John Lovell on one of a fleet of ships owned by the Hawkins family, they attacked Portuguese settlements and slave ships on the coast of West Africa, and then sailed to the Americas and sold the captured cargoes of enslaved Africans to Spanish plantations. The voyage was largely unsuccessful and more than 90 enslaved Africans were released without payment. When Lavelle arrived back in Plymouth in 1567 with these disappointing results, Hawkins' third troublesome voyage, or fourth if Lavelle's is included, was planned, and it would be a turning point in Drake's life. So there's two things to pick out here. They took the slaves and everything else because it was an attack on the Spanish economy, basically. But then they sold them to the Spanish plantations. So the people on the plantations, you know, they weren't fussy about where they got their workers from. They didn't care if they got them from the Spanish or the English. They just needed to get workers. And also, they freed 90 of them. So why isn't he referred to as being a great slave emancipator? You know, they just let these 90 enslaved Africans go for free. Anything you want to say on that, Max?
Well, just that in parts of Africa, like the Congo, for example, the slave trade has continued to exist up to very recent times. In particular, the enslavement of the pygmy tribes of the central Congo by the larger, presumably Bantu tribes that occupy most of that area now.
Yeah, I did a narration the other day, which was by one of the officers in Sir Henry Morgan Stanley's crew, and he was recording the African slave trade in the Congo. And this was after it had actually been banned, the Atlantic slave trade, and it was still going on in the Congo. And he was recording the sort of things that went on, and the slaves would be eaten, basically. When their owner died, they would be sacrificed and they would also be eaten. And they were treated in absolutely appalling ways. And I can imagine that an Englishman, upon seeing that, would have thought, well, surely it would be better for these slaves to be in America, owned by white people, where they'd be looked after, where they wouldn't be sacrificed if their owner dies. They would be set free and given a pension. And you can imagine them looking at it and thinking, well, that would be much better than the situation that they are actually in. So, I don't think they were looking at it thinking, let's be as mean as possible as we can to these people, because Sir Henry Morgan Stanley's crew member is obviously looking at them with compassion, and he's trying to think of ways that this can be stopped. And this was long after we'd actually banned the transatlantic slave trade. The Africans were still engaging in it. It was part of their economy. And I think, you know, it was wrong of them to do, but I can imagine them thinking, well, they're going to be much better off with a white owner, aren't they? And what Drake was doing was taking slaves that had already been purchased, and he was then taking them and then selling them on as booty, along with anything else that was on the ships, you know, ivory, gold, and what have you. Well, one account of the troublesome third voyage has Drake as the captain of Hawkins' ship Judith from the beginning of the voyage, whereas another account places him as a junior officer aboard the Jesus of Lubeck instead. Whitfield says the voyage began badly and it grew progressively worse. The voyage ended in the ill-fated 1568 incident at San Juan de Lua. Storms, Spanish hostility and African resistance, armed conflict and finally a hurricane separated one ship from the fleet to find its own way home and damaged the others, forcing them to find a port where they could make repairs. After arriving in San Juan de Lua, the port of Veracruz, the newly appointed Viceroy of New Spain arrived with a fleet of ships. While still negotiating to resupply and repair, Hawkins' ships were attacked by the fleet of Spanish warships, with all but two of the English ships lost. The Jesus de Lubeck was set on fire. Drake escaped, surviving the attack by swimming. The Judith departed, leaving Hawkins and the Minion to limp along alone towards safety. Hundreds of English seamen were abandoned, and Drake's hostility towards the Spanish is said to have started with this incident. And that very fact in itself implies that when Drake was doing the same to the Spaniards, he never would have left the seamen there to drown. They took the crews, they took them prisoner, but they looked after them, they used them as hostages. They would never have just sunk the ships and just left the seamen to drown. And that was the origin of his animosity to the Spaniards. I mean, that continued, you know, not allowing these people to drown, that continued up until the First World War, because I think there was the sinking of the Lusitania or one of those, and that's what really upset the Germans, is that we didn't rescue them afterwards. It's a terrible thing to do. So this was going on back then, and that's what turned Drake against the Spaniards. And it shows that he was chivalrous in his treatment of the hostages that he took, and of the ships that that they, I guess, what is the word you would use? Not hijacked. So it's almost like a highwayman, but at sea, isn't it? Give us all your goods, or we'll scuttle the ship and take you prisoner. Well, details of the aftermath have remained unclear. Hawkins accused Drake of desertion and of stealing the treasure they had accumulated. Drake denied both accusations, asserting that he had distributed all the profits among the crew and that he had believed Hawkins was lost when he left. Other eyewitness accounts exonerate Drake. Whatever the truth about this episode, there is no doubt that it turned Drake's ambitions into a new channel. Thereafter, Spain and all things Spanish became his prey. Slaving and trading voyages no longer interested him. An ignoble ambition, perhaps, but the circumstances of European politics in the 1570s and 1580s, combined with Drake's personal brilliance and tenacious character, served to transform it into a plan of historic importance. Now, they say it's ignoble here, but really, I mean, he's defending his country. And it's before they've actually declared war against Spain, but there is problems with the Spain. The Spanish have been doing things to the British, and this was seen as a way that they could get their own back without actually bothering to declare war. And it does look as if he was telling the truth here. He gave the profits away. Well, in 1572, Drake embarked on his first major independent enterprise. He planned an attack on the Isthmus of Panama, known to the Spanish as Tierra Firma and to the English as the Spanish Main. This was the point at which the silver and gold treasure of Peru had to be landed and then sent overland to the Caribbean Sea, where galleons from Spain would pick it up at the town of Nombre de Dios. Drake left Plymouth on the 24th of May, 1572, with a crew of 73 men in two small vessels, the Pasha, which was 70 tons, and the Swan, which was 25 tons, and the plan was to capture the Nombre de Dios. The most celebrated of Drake's adventures along the Spanish Main was his capture of the Nombre de Dios in March 1573. He raided the waters around Darien, which is in modern Panama, with a crew including many French privateers, including Willem Le Testu, a French buccaneer, and Maroons, enslaved Africans who had escaped from their Spanish slave owners. One of these men was Diego, who under Drake became a free man. Diego was also a capable shipbuilder. Drake tracked the silver train to the nearby port of Nombre de Dios, and after their attack on the richly laden mule train, Drake and his party found that they had captured around 20 tons of silver and gold. They buried much of the treasure, as it was too much for their party to carry, and made off with a fortune in gold. An account of this may have given rise to subsequent stories of pirates and their buried treasure. Wounded, Le Testu was captured and later beheaded. The small band of adventurers dragged as much gold and silver as they could carry back across some 18 miles of jungle-covered mountains to where they had left the raiding boats. When they got to the coast, the boats were gone. Drake and his men, downhearted, exhausted and hungry, had nowhere to go, and the Spanish were not far behind. At this point, he rallied his men, buried the treasure on the beach, and built a raft to sail with two volunteers 10 miles along the surf-lashed coast to where they had left the flagship. When he finally reached its deck, his men were alarmed at his bedraggled appearance, and fearing the worst, they asked him how the raid had gone. Drake could not resist a joke and teased them by looking downhearted. Then he laughed, pulled a necklace of Spanish gold from around his neck and said, "Our voyage is made, lads." And by the 9th of August 1573, they had returned to Plymouth. And it was during this expedition that Drake climbed a high tree in the central mountains of the Isthmus of Panama and thus became the first Englishman to see the Pacific Ocean. And he remarked as he saw it that he hoped that one day an Englishman would be able to sail it, which he would then do years later as part of his circumnavigation of the world. And when Drake returned to Plymouth after the raids, the government signed a temporary truce with King Philip of Spain. And so the British government was unable to acknowledge Drake's accomplishment officially. But he was considered a hero in England from this time and a pirate in Spain for his raids. So 20 tons of gold and silver. That might tie in with what you were saying there at the beginning, Max, about them collecting all this gold and silver from the mines in Peru. So this wasn't like the Spanish were really industrious and making all this wealth. They were basically taking it from Peru. And
I can't remember where I read it, but it was an account of the Spanish mining precious metal in South America. And I'm glad that the notes that you have show that it was Peru. But the mines that they had in this particular location, there was a particular location where there were the largest seams of precious metal anywhere in the world, and so it was just that the Spanish had got effectively a factory there where they were just melting the raw ore that they dug out of the ground and minting doubloons, I think it was. And these doubloons were then putting chests and loaded aboard ships and sailed off. And this is where, you know, all the sort of like romantic raiding Pirates of the Caribbean type of stories that, you know, are all sort of based upon legends emanating from this of rival nations, privateers and buccaneers and pirates all competing with each other to steal the treasure and get it back to Europe to benefit their home nation.
Yeah, this is where it must have all come from. And I guess after he'd made this raft and made it back to his ship, they must have gone back to the beach there and dug it up and taken it back with them. I mean, it's quite an exciting life to be had back then. There's something negative that he is associated with is a massacre that took place in Ireland, the Rathlin Island Massacre. Where 200 defenders and 400 civilians who had surrendered were actually killed. And they tried to use this to put a blot on his record. But he was not actually present at this massacre. He was actually at sea preventing the reinforcements from arriving at the island. It was whoever it was that was on the island that was actually responsible for this, but they tried to link him into that. And that happened after he got back to England after this, and obviously the Queen would have made a lot of money from this, because the monarch made 50% from everything that was taken by these privateers. And if you imagine, England was in a very poor state at that time, the black slaves that were in England were actually better off than the white peasants that were unemployed. So this would have been a big boost to England's coffers. Well, shall we go back and take a look at times when the monarch did actually have this power, Max? Shall we take a look at our greatest Britons?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, we're going to be talking once again about Sir Francis Drake, and we'll begin with a recap. In the last episode, we heard how Sir Francis Drake started life as the son of a Protestant preacher who got a commission to preach to the Navy. Drake became a sailor at a young age, working for a man called John Hawkins, who sought to muscle in on the trade that Spain was involved in. England was not at war with Spain, but covert hostilities were taking place between the two. And when Drake saw the Spanish abandon hundreds of English seamen to their deaths after a battle at sea with them, he decided to become a privateer, a licensed pirate, attacking any Spanish ships that they saw. After capturing tons of treasure from the Spanish gold mines in the New World on a wagon train, Drake climbed up a tree and saw the Pacific Ocean for the first time, and determined to be the first Englishman to navigate it. We also heard how after he took slaves as a booty from the Spanish, he would free them if they could not be sold and give them certificates of freedom to prove that they were a free man. And he took on one of these slaves, Diego, as part of his crew. And yet, despite that, he is still cancelled by the progressives today, despite the good way that he actually treated his slaves. We'll hear more about Diego as we get on with our presentation here. Have you got any comments you want to make on that recap, Max?
Well, it's a surprise. It's surprising when you read the things that you've just been saying about Sir Francis Drake, just how similar his attitude to other people was to the attitude of Cecil Rhodes. Because Cecil Rhodes is somebody who's who's a woke artie in this country, are trying to cancel and are trying to pull down his statues and erase him from the history books. And yet Cecil Rhodes dealt with people, and as far as his exploits and adventures in Africa were concerned, you know, he didn't treat the natives as if they were of no account. He made alliances with the various native tribes of Africa and dealt honourably with the leaders of those tribes in order to increase the influence of Britain in Africa at that time. And so that's very, very similar, in fact, to the way in which Sir Francis Drake dealt with non-white people.
Yeah, I don't, he certainly wasn't prejudiced against them. I don't think he was prejudiced against anyone. He wasn't happy with the Spanish because of what the Spanish did, because they just allowed all these English seamen to drown. Well, with the success of the Panama Isthmus raid, that was the raid on the mule train where they got tons of silver and gold. In 1577, Elizabeth I of England sent Drake to start an expedition against the Spanish along the Pacific coast of the Americas. Drake acted on the plan authored by Sir Richard Grenville, who had received a royal patent for it in 1574. Just 1 year later, the patent was rescinded after protests from Philip of Spain. Diego, that's the freed slave, was once again employed under Drake. His fluency in Spanish and English would make him a useful interpreter when Spaniards or Spanish-speaking Portuguese were captured. He was employed as Drake's servant and was paid wages, just like the rest of the crew. Drake and the fleet set out from Plymouth on 15th of November 1577, but bad weather threatened him and his fleet, so they were forced to take refuge in Falmouth, Cornwall, from where they returned to Plymouth for repair. And there's places all over Cornwall that are named after Sir Francis Drake. He's one of their most famous sons. After this major setback, Drake set sail again on the 13th of December aboard the Pelican with four other ships and 164 men. He soon added a sixth ship, the Mary, formerly the Santa Maria, a Portuguese merchant ship that had been captured off the coast of Africa near the Cape Verde Islands. He also added its captain, Nuno da Silva, a man with considerable experience navigating in South American waters. Drake's fleet suffered great attrition. He scuttled both the Christopher and the flyboat the Swan due to loss of men on the Atlantic crossing. He made landfall at the gloomy bay of San Julian in what is now Argentina. Ferdinand Magellan had called here half a century earlier, where he put to death some mutineers, and Drake's men saw weathered and bleached skeletons on the grim Spanish gibbets. Following Magellan's example, Drake tried and executed his own mutineer, Thomas Doughty, on charges of witchcraft, mutiny, and treason. And Drake was obviously, he was brought up by a preacher. He was a Christian, and he saw that what this Thomas Doughty was doing was anti-Christian witchcraft. So he had him beheaded. The crew discovered that the Mary had rotting timbers, so they burned the ship. And Drake decided to remain for the winter in San Julian before attempting the Strait of Magellan. The three remaining ships of his convoy departed for the Magellan Strait at the southern tip of South America. And a few weeks later, September 1578, Drake made it into the Pacific. But violent storms destroyed one of the three ships, the Marigold, which was captained by John Thomas in the Strait, and caused another, the Elizabeth, which was captained by John Winter, to return to England, leaving only the Pelican. So they started out with four ships, and they're now down to only one. After this passage, the Pelican was pushed south and discovered an island that Drake called Elizabeth Island. Drake, like navigators before him, probably reached a latitude of 55 degrees south, according to astronomical data quoted in Hakluyt's The Principal Navigations, Voyages and Discoveries of the English Nation of 1589, and that was along the Chilean coast. In the Magellan Strait, Francis and his men engaged in a skirmish with local indigenous people, becoming the first Europeans to kill indigenous peoples in southern Patagonia. Well, I mean, it was the local indigenous people that started the fight. Basically, it wouldn't have been Drake that attacked these people. I mean, this is always the case, isn't it? The indigenous or the natives end up fighting against the Europeans, and today we get told, oh, the wicked, evil Europeans killed the indigenous peoples, but they were fighting for their lives. It was the same with Captain Cook in New Zealand. During the stay in the Strait, crew members discovered that an infusion made of the bark of Drimmi's wintery could be used as a remedy against scurvy. Captain Winter ordered the collection of great amounts of this bark, hence the scientific name. That's where the wintry bit comes from. So that was extremely useful. Scurvy was a terrible problem that they had on these long voyages. Historian Matineau Martinique, who examined his travels, credits Drake with the discovery of the southern end of the Americas and the oceanic space that is south of it. The first report of his discovery of an open channel south of Tierra del Fuego was written after the 1618 publication of the voyage of Willem Schouten and Jacob Lemery around Cape Horn in 1616. So they say that he was the first Englishman to actually do this, but he actually discovered the southern end of the Americas, and I guess he would have been mapping this as well. So again, he's rather like Christopher... who's that I'm thinking of? The guy that I just mentioned, Captain Cook. So he's rather like Captain Cook. He's not just an adventurer, not just a pirateer, but he's also a map maker and making new discoveries. You got any comments on any of that, Max?
I was just trying to think, actually, what Tierra del Fuego means. Obviously, Tierra means land and del of. It'd just be interesting to have confirmed what the Fuego means, but I can't quite remember it. My sort of assumption is it might be fire, or it might be sort of storm or something like that, because I'd imagine that the passage round Tierra del Fuego has always been a fairly sort of windy and blustery at best passage, and so sailors would be taking their life in their hands to pass through that. But I think Magellan was the person who found the passage between Tierra del Fuego and the mainland of the South American continent, and who possibly was the first person to get through one of the earliest people to get through into the Pacific. But as you say, Drake was the first Englishman to do that.
And the first to map that area. And this is the sea that he had seen when he climbed up the tree, although those months back or years back, just after they were trying to escape from the Spanish after burying the treasure. Well, Drake pushed onwards in his lone flagship, which he had now renamed the Golden Hind in honour of Sir Christopher Hatton, and that was after his coat of arms. The Golden Hind sailed north along the Pacific coast of South America, attacking Spanish ports and pillaging towns. Some Spanish ships were captured, and Drake used their more accurate charts. Before reaching the coast of Peru, Drake visited Mocha Island, where he was seriously injured by the hostile Mapuche. Later, he sacked the port of Valparaiso, further north in Chile, where he also captured a ship full of Chilean wine. Near Lima, Drake captured a Spanish ship with 25,000 pesos of Peruvian gold, amounting in value to 37,000 ducats of Spanish money, about £7 million by modern standards. Drake also discovered news of another ship, the Nuestra Señora de la Concepción, which was sailing west towards Manila. It would come to be called the Cacafuego. Drake gave chase and eventually captured the treasure ship, which proved to be his most profitable capture. So he's near the Philippines at this time, if he's near Manila. Mm. Aboard Nuestra Señora de la Concepción, Drake found 36 kilos of gold, a golden crucifix, jewels, 13 chests full of royals of plate, and 26,000 kilos, or 26 long tons, of silver. Drake was naturally pleased at his good luck in capturing the galleon, and he showed it by dining with the captured ship's officers and the gentlemen passengers. He offloaded his captives a short time later and gave each one gifts appropriate to their rank, as well as a letter of safe conduct. So this shows us the way that these privateers operated. They were fighting against Spain. We weren't yet in open hostilities against Spain. But what they would do is that they would take the ships and they would say, we are taking everything that's on here, but they wouldn't harm the passengers. And this is the opposite of what the Spaniards did when they left the English to drown. So they make out that Drake was this terrible pirate, but he wasn't behaving like a pirate. I mean, he was making sure that the people that were on the ship were treated in the way that they were used to being treated. And you've got the captured ship's officers here, and he sits down and dines with them, has dinner with them, and gives each one of them gifts, and then they have a letter of safe conduct. It was like when he freed the slaves, they all had a letter saying that they were a free man. It wasn't that they were on the run, and he had the authority to do this from the Queen of England, from Queen Elizabeth I. Any comments on this, Max?
Well, it's just a continuation of the kind of chivalry that existed in medieval times amongst knights, really, isn't it? You know, it's a very chivalrous way for a privateer to behave, and behaving in such a way that he's doing upholding the interests of his nation, but at the same time doing it in a way in which nobody could really condemn him for.
Very chivalrous, yeah. I mean, keeping up English traditions of treating people well and being honourable, basically. Well, prior to Drake's voyage, the western coast of North America had only been partially explored in 1542 by Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo, who sailed for Spain. So, intending to avoid further conflict with Spain, Drake navigated northwest of the Spanish presence and sought a discreet site at which the crew could prepare for their journey back to England. On the 5th of June 1579, the ship briefly made first landfall at what is now South Cove, Cape Arago, just south of Coos Bay, Oregon, and then sailed south while searching for a suitable harbour to repair his ailing ship. On the 17th of June, Drake and his crew found a protected cove when they landed on the Pacific coast of what is now Northern California. While ashore, he claimed the area for Queen Elizabeth I as Nova Albion, or New Albion. To document and assert his claim, Drake posted an engraved plate of brass to claim sovereignty for Elizabeth and every successive English monarch. After erecting a fort and tents ashore, the crew laboured for several weeks as they prepared for the circumnavigating voyage ahead by careening their ship, Golden Hind, so to effectively clean and repair the hull. Drake had friendly interactions with the Coast Miwok, a Red Indian tribe, and explored the surrounding land by foot. When his ship was ready for the return voyage, Drake and the crew left New Albion on 23rd of July and paused his journey the next day when anchoring his ship at the Farallon Islands, where the crew hunted for seal meat. So we can see here that he had friendly interactions with the Red Indians. So he would be trying to make peace with them at first, but if they fought back, then obviously the English would have to fight back with overwhelming firepower. It wasn't that they were mistreating the natives here at all. And I guess when you're going out and you're discovering new lands, if they don't find evidence of civilization, if they just find that there are some people there that are living in tents that are just moving about, then they're going to claim that for themselves, aren't they? And they're going to see that the resources aren't being used by these peoples. They're not advanced enough to be making use of the resources there. And we need the resources. You know, you're talking of a time when people would have families of 9 or 10 children, and the eldest would be in receipt of whatever the parents had. That would be left to the eldest, but all the rest of them, they would have to go out and do something, and they would have to go out and look for new land. I mean, that's what the Danes were doing when they came to England. That's what the Vikings were doing when they came to England. And the same thing's going on 1,000 years later, when you've got the English going to the New World, searching for new land. And if you look at how populated America is now, that just shows you how this needed to be done. And the strongest force is going to win over the weaker force. And it's not that we mistreated these Indians, as it says here. You know, He had friendly interactions with them. They would make peace treaties with them. They would say, well, can we have this bit of land here? We want to do what we want to do here. You have your bit of land there. And most of the Indians were okay about it, but there were other tribes that would start robbing the English and start robbing the settlers. And that was the origin of the Red Indian Wars. And unlike battles in the past, when the vanquished foe becomes your slave or kills himself, which is what we used to do in the past, rather than accept slavery, you would fall on your sword. And that was the agreement. If you lost the war, you either became a slave or you fell on your sword. Instead of doing that, we gave the Red Indians reservations. And we said, here you are, you can have this land, you can have your own laws, and make your own rules there. And we even honoured them by naming our helicopters and our tanks after these Red Indian tribes. And it just shows you that, the white man is an honourable man. And he's even honourable in battle, or he used to be, up until the last century, and yet we smear these people, and we say that they were terrible racists and white supremacists. I think they were decent people trying to do the right thing. Got any comments on any of this, Max?
Well, just to say that the thing that people always forget when they talk about when they condemn the colonial period was the fact that all of the various tribes of in North America and South America prior to European explorers going there were all fighting each other for their land. You know, it wasn't that they were all living in a sort of blissful kind of paradise and that we arrived and then upset the apple cart and started killing everybody. It's a matter that when explorers landed on these new continents, what they found was that some of the people that they encountered were peaceful people who were who dealt with them civilly, but that there were other tribes who were the warlike tribes who attacked the Europeans just as readily as they would have attacked other American Indian or Indigenous American tribes, and that very often the fate for the tribes that were beaten in battle was that they would just be slaughtered and genocided. And so the fact that when our explorers went to these places and encountered warlike tribes, the fact that we fought against them and defeated them isn't a sign of our cruelty. It's a sign that of the cruelty that existed before we even went there.
Well, it's a dog-eat-dog world, isn't it? And the point is that we gave these people mercy, and we didn't want to just wipe them out and steal their land from them. We wanted to live in peace alongside them. And where that wasn't possible, we had to show overwhelming force and then give them reservations. And it was the same in all these countries in the New World that we discovered. It was always the hand of peace that was offered to them first. And as we see here, it worked okay with Drake at this point, but in that earlier point, he was attacked. Well, Drake left the Pacific coast, heading southwest to catch the winds that would carry his ship across the Pacific, and a few months later he reached the Moluccas, a group of islands in the Western Pacific in eastern modern-day Indonesia. I mean, he's going right the way around the world here, isn't he? Now he's up near Asia and Malaysia. At this time, Diego died from wounds he had sustained earlier in the voyage, and Drake was saddened at his death as he had become a good friend. So why are they trying to get rid of his statues in his honour today? I mean, this is a slave that he freed that became a good friend that was a good worker on the ship, and yet we're told, oh no, we've got to cancel him completely because he had something to do with a captain that took slaves from the Spaniards and then sold them on in the Americas and freed the ones that he wasn't able to sell. So Drake was, he wasn't prejudiced against these people. If somebody was good at what they did, then he was going to take them on as part of his crew, which he did with Diego. The Golden Hind later became caught on a reef and was almost lost. After the sailors waited 3 days for convenient tides and had dumped the cargo, Drake eventually rounded the Cape of Good Hope and reached Sierra Leone by the 22nd of July, 1580. So now they're back in Africa. I hope they didn't dump the gold and the silver. I mean, that must have been an awful situation if they had to dump the gold and silver. I'm sure they must have dropped that off and buried that somewhere on the way so that they could pick it up at another time, I would have thought. Imagine that, you know, the ship's going down and it's full of gold and silver. Half the crew is not going to want to throw that away, are they?
No, I would think that it's almost certain that they would have just offloaded the cargo, buried it somewhere, and then because the ship would then be more buoyant, they would then be able to refloat it and get it off of the reef. And then once they'd done that, they would have gone back, dug up the treasure, put it back on the ship and sailed it home.
Yeah, that's the origin of all these buried treasure tales, isn't it, from things like that happening. On the 26th of September, the Golden Hind sailed into Plymouth with Drake and 59 remaining crew on board, along with a rich cargo of spices and captured Spanish treasures. The Queen's half share of the cargo surpassed the rest of the Crown's income for that entire year. Drake was hailed as the first Englishman to circumnavigate the Earth, and the second such voyage, arriving with at least one ship intact after Elcano's in 1520. The Queen declared that all written accounts of Drake's voyages were to become the Queen's secrets of the realm, and Drake and the other participants of his voyages, on the pain of death, are sworn to their secrecy. She intended to keep Drake's activities away from the eyes of rival Spain. Drake presented the Queen with a jewel token commemorating the circumnavigation. Taken as a prize off the Pacific coast of Mexico, it was made of enameled gold and bore an African diamond and a ship with an ebony hull. For her part, the Queen gave Drake a jewel with her portrait, an unusual gift to bestow upon a commoner, and one that Drake sported proudly in his 1591 portrait by Marcus Geraerts, now seen at the National Maritime Museum, Greenwich. On one side is a state portrait of Elizabeth by the miniaturist Nicholas Hilliard, on the other a sardonyx cameo of double portrait busts, a regal woman and an African male. The Drake jewel, as it is known today, is a rare documented survivor amongst 16th century jewels. It is conserved at the Victoria and Albert Museum, London. And I should imagine the Africans are probably saying, can we have back the jewel? I mean, they're always doing this now, aren't they? Trying to get back things that we collected many years ago that we have preserved in our museums. And interesting here that the double portrait bust shows a regal woman and an African male. I guess that's basically showing the exotic nature of where it is that Drake has gone, where they have different human beings that look completely different to the ones in England. Queen Elizabeth.
I think that'd be symbolising the regal woman. Probably would be that would probably be a representation of the Queen, and the inclusion of those two figures would be to demonstrate the Queen having an encounter with Africa, basically, with the African man representing Africa.
Yeah, the Queen having the encounter via her subject, her loyal servant, Sir Francis Drake. And again, I mean, when he made that plate as well and claimed that land for her in New Albion, and he's naming places after the Queen as well. Well, Queen Elizabeth awarded Drake a knighthood aboard the Golden Hind in Deptford on the 4th of April 1581, the dubbing being performed by a French diplomat, Monsieur de Marchemont, who was negotiating for Elizabeth to marry the King of France's brother, Francis, the Duke of Anjou. And listeners will remember we talked about all these attempts to try and get Elizabeth I married, all these diplomatic attempts when we looked at Elizabeth I, and this ties in with one of those. By getting the French diplomat involved in the knighting, Elizabeth was gaining the implicit political support from the French for Drake's actions. During the Victorian era, in a spirit of nationalism, the story was promoted that Elizabeth I had actually done the knighting. After receiving his knighthood, Drake unilaterally adopted the armorials of the ancient Devon family of Drake of Ash near Musbury, to whom he claimed a distant but unspecified kinship. These arms were argent, a wyvern wings displayed and tail-nailed gules, and the crest a dexter arm proper, grasping a battle-axe sable headed argent. The head of that family, also a distinguished sailor, Sir Bernard Drake, in 1586 angrily refuted Sir Francis's claimed kinship and his right to bear his family's arms. That dispute led to a box on the ear being given to Sir Francis by Sir Bernard at court, as recorded by John Prince in his Worthies of Devon, first published in 1701. So this is rather strange here. You've got Sir Francis Drake, who has just got England more money more wealth than the Queen has managed to get for herself in an entire year. He's just circumnavigated the globe. And he says, well, I have a distant kinship to this family. And the head of that family refutes the kinship and says, you can't wear my family's arms, and gets him boxed on the ear at court. I mean, that's really bizarre. You would think that they would want to be associated with him. I don't understand.
Perhaps this Bernard fellow had asked Drake for payment in return for being able to display the family's coat of arms, and Drake perhaps had declined and expected the guy to just be happy that Drake was going to associate with his family, and therefore the feud between them grew up.
That's a good point. You know, that could have been something like that. Queen Elizabeth, to assuage matters, awarded Sir Francis his own coat of arms, blazoned as follows: sable, a fess wavy between two pole stars, Arctic and Antarctic, argent, and for his crest, a ship on a globe under ruff, held by a cable with a hand out of the clouds. Over it, this motto, auxilio divino. Underneath, sic parvis magna. And in the rigging, whereof is hung up by the heels, a wyvern gules, which was the arms of Sir Bernard Drake. The motto, sic parvis magna, translated literally, is, thus great things from small things come. And the hand out of the clouds, labelled auxilio divino, means with divine help. The full achievement is depicted in the form of a large coloured plaster over mantel in the Lifetimes Gallery at Buckland Abbey. Nevertheless, Drake continued to quarter his new arms with the wyvern gules, the arms adopted by his nephew Sir Francis Drake, 1st Baronet of Buckland, were the arms of Drake of Ashe, but the wyvern without a node or knotted tail. So he really seemed to want to keep this coat of arms that was actually there from this St. Bernard. And I do like the Queen's sense of humour there, giving him a completely different coat of arms with the wyvern being hung up by the heels in the rigging. And that's great, isn't it? You know, just sort of showing what she thinks of it. And Drake continued to command ships against Spain after war was officially declared, and he went on to attack Spanish colonies before going on to replenish supplies at Sir Walter Raleigh's colony and finally arriving home at Plymouth to a hero's welcome. And it's after that we get to the Spanish Armada, so it's probably an opportune moment here to pause. Have you got any comments on all of this today, Max, before we finish?
Well, I think it all just demonstrates what a great character Drake was, and the sort of person who is very rare nowadays, but I suspect was probably more commonly found in times gone by, as this series of Great Britons tends to demonstrate. And it's impossible to think that he could be anything other than a very likeable and impressive character, basically.
He's a fantastic example of an Englishman, isn't he, when you think about it?
Absolutely.
And I do like this example we have here of Queen Elizabeth's humour as well. Thank you very much for listening, and keep an eye out for part 2 in this mini-series on Sir Francis Drake.